Great, thanks for doing that. And as I always begin retreats, you know, when I welcome you, I do mean that word in the deepest sense of the word. And just a reminder about this community that we're cultivating here together for this weekend is predicated upon this quality of welcome. It's really one of the essential conditions for the unfolding of this path and this practice. And the way I describe that this sense of a full welcome is if you've ever had the experience of the opposite, which is you come into a group and somebody up here says welcome, and you feel welcomed, but it can leave you with this lingering feeling like, oh, is this going to be a space where my sexual orientation is actually fully welcomed here or not? Or you walk into a space and it's like, wow, I feel welcome, but in terms of how I identify in the realm of gender, remember, you know, gender is not some simple binary thing. Wow, is that going to be fully welcomed here or not? You know, or in terms of my ability, it could be also, you know, am I going to be fully welcomed here? In terms of my physical health or mental health, just because there can be so much stigma around both of those dimensions of our lives that can leave us with a feeling of, wow, is this going to be fully welcomed here? And the list goes on, race, ethnicity, you know, nationality, what our mother tongue is. And hopefully you're hearing this is a list of the places where you might not quite fit into the dominant group of whatever groups you enter into, and it can leave a lingering feeling of, is this the kind of group that I'm going to be fully welcomed or not? So in light of that, I want to make sure that you do feel fully welcomed here. And if for some reason the way the retreat is being held, or the way I'm expressing this practice, or the way I'm not expressing, you know, the community that we're creating together, do let me know, because, you know, if it's leaving a lingering feeling of exclusion, I want to know so that we can, you know, address that in some manner. Yeah, so welcome to our retreat. And I also feel like it's a chance when we begin to really just welcome whatever's here. You know, if you're starting to feel drowsy, sleepy, you know, if your body is filled with aches and pains, or if there's a little bit of a nervousness or trepidation about being here, to allow for a quality of welcome. Because it's such a basis of the practice that we're doing, and which I'm sure you'll get a sense of as we, you know, dive into this. You know, if there's excitement or eagerness or a bubbliness, to really, that too gets welcomed. Not being lost in that, welcoming it. And you can say that's going to be so much the heart of what we're doing here is, can you clarify for yourself when I'm lost in an experience and when I'm actually being present with it, when I'm welcoming it? Also, as a way of beginning, I want to begin by honoring this tradition that we get to step into. And, you know, I think the phrase that fits so well for me in terms of honoring a tradition is a phrase that probably many of you are familiar with, is this, it's this experience of standing on the shoulders of giants. That it's not something that, you know, what we get and what we're learning here is not just something that, you know, we've learned from Jon Kabat-Zinn or Jack Kornfield. Wonderful people. But when we do that, then we deny 2,600 years of a whole tradition and literally thousands upon thousands of practitioners who have made it possible for us to do this practice and have shared the wisdom through different cultures and different perspectives to allow us to stand on the shoulders of giants so that we don't have to start just on our own. And I feel like it allows us to enter in with a sense of gratitude and also hopefully with a sense of humility of what we're engaging in together. Yeah, so to honor this tradition of, you could say, this Theravada tradition or this early Buddhist tradition, which most of what I'm speaking about, but also, you know, using language that hopefully fits our modern times and our modern sensibilities. And also honoring this land and the peoples who have come before us on this land. Beautiful morning. It's just so, I while we were driving up here, I was driving up with Greg. Thank you for driving us all up here. And I was stunned to think that you all get to wake up in the morning and to be around these really so emotionally moving mountains, and how deeply moving it is to be in such country like this. It really is, I think, it calls to me in terms of a spiritual practice. And again, so important to begin with honoring the land that we come to sit upon together. And also the peoples who come before us, because there is such a tendency in history to forget who has come before us on this land. I think mostly, and please correct me, that it was mostly the Ute tribe that was here before most of us, and you know, maybe the ancient ones. And I name that just so we remain aware of kind of the dynamics of this land of colonization and how it also leaves an impact on our minds and on the land itself. And because that this practice is about, it's about, you know, moving out of suffering, which is in some ways acknowledging those kinds of dynamics. The theme for this retreat, this weekend, if you read the flyer, maybe you didn't. I know that sometimes folks just come to retreat, which has been problematic. Remember when we've had these, sometimes we've had these mindful speech retreats and people just kind of come and it's like, what do you mean? We're going to be talking? But that's not this retreat. This is a silent retreat. But so just for those of you who didn't look at the flyer, it's on intention. And this placing intention. And I'd like to begin with a story that I feel situates the importance of intention. Actually, quite a few years ago, a friend of mine had the opportunity to be with his uncle in the months leading up to his death. You know, because of the particular condition that he had, he was aware that he was dying. He had a particular, you know, prognosis of how long he was going to be living. And he'd received this prognosis when he still was very cognizant, really quite aware. Still his faculties were working quite fine. And so he went out there, my friend, to be with them. And when he got there, you know, he wanted to make sure there was a chance to really discuss the remaining time that he had in his life, kind of how it was impacting him, what he wanted to do with that time, and how he wanted to, most importantly, live the remaining time of his life. And, you know, after some struggle, what became clear is really he wanted to spend his time watching TV, you know, kind of watching football games. And really wasn't interested in connecting beyond that. You know, he wasn't interested in saying goodbye or saying I love you to the ones who he was close to. Just not interested. And to me, the story was quite a shock and felt tragic that to be in such a situation. And what my friend said, which I found so poignant and revealing, is he said, you know, well, these are the conditions that he cultivated throughout his life. So these are the conditions he was going to die with. It was that simple. This is how life unfolds. There are certain conditions that we cultivate, certain intentions that we place, and then it shapes our lives. You know, he had an intention to be in the world in a certain way. intention around a certain way of dying. And you could say, well, maybe he wasn't placing intentions. That was the problem. But I think it's important to see that when I don't place intentions, there are still intentions at play. And if you're not choosing, then often what you fall back on are just societal intentions, whether it be living a consumeristic life, or especially in modern times, what comes with modernity is a sense of a feeling of dislocation and disconnection. Those are the conditions that we often are just habitually playing out. What intentions or what conditions do you want to shape your life? And if you don't choose, your life is still being shaped. And I think that's the tricky thing, is that we're just on automatic pilot, and those conditions start to get reinforced. And not only do they shape my life, but they actually shape the world I live in. You know, we are a collective. You could say we're just on one planet together, not many different planets, one planet. And it's our intentions that we're carrying out, whether consciously or unconsciously, that's shaping really literally this Earth and this planet. And so it's making that decision to, as Thoreau said, to live deliberately. You know, as he famously said, I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. So this weekend, you know, it's we're just exploring one primary intention, this willingness to be present, because it can have such a huge impact on how it shapes our lives and our world. So important. And for those of you who are going to be exploring the residency, really, this is all we're exploring, is we're going to have this exploring, continue to explore this willingness to be present after the retreat. We haven't touched on that as much in depth, but you might have remembered Friday evening, which I want to also mention, is there were other intentions I was asking you to get clear about around ethics and how we are in the world, how we're acting in the world, about bringing in that which is wholesome for the same thing, because it's about cultivating conditions. It's about placing an intention and then allowing it to unfold. So I want to say a little bit about the whole process of how that works, both for what we're doing this weekend, this willingness to be present, and also to tie it in for those of you who are going to be extending this whole practice period, you could call it. In early Buddhism, Buddhism is really interesting. If you look at different schools of Buddhism or how Buddhism unfolds over the centuries, even within one school of Buddhism like Theravada, you get sometimes different narratives or different stories about how this practice works or how this path towards awakening unfolds, which I really appreciate. I think a multiplicity of stories is so important, just because it can then speak to a multiplicity of people. So when I share this with you, I'm just sharing with you one story. Remember, it's just a story. I like it. It's a good story. But the main story that you find that really that you see the Buddha coming back again and again, and you can see it how it underlies so much of the teachings, is it's the story of cultivating and abandoning. So in a lot around cultivating certain conditions. So much of the entirety of, you could almost pick any teaching and see, oh, this is about cultivation, maybe abandonment at the same time or differently. If you look at the Four Noble Truths, it's a cultivating the Eightfold Path. You know, if you look at, like, there's these teachings of the seven factors of awakening, to cultivate those, you know, the five hindrances, to abandon them. You know, dependent origination is all about conditions, the ones to cultivate, the ones to abandon. And really, when we're talking about being present, this willingness to be present, it is this process of cultivation, just as you can cultivate loving kindness or compassion, cultivate patience or samadhi or concentration. And the word for cultivation, the Pali word, Pali being the early scriptural language of Buddhism, is bhavana. So some of you, I don't know, who's done a Goenka retreat here? Anybody did the 10-day Goenka retreat? It's just, okay, great. Okay, a couple. So you might have remembered Goenka talking about metta bhavana, you know, before he does his chanting and things like that. It's just a term for, or samadhi bhavana. It's just the cultivation of these different qualities, cultivating concentration, cultivating loving kindness. And one translator conjectures, and I really appreciate this, Glenn Wallace, to imagine the context within which the Buddha was using this word bhavana. If you were to imagine the Buddha sitting down and giving a teaching, what was he looking out onto? He's probably looking out onto all of these fields that were being cultivated, right? Rice fields and other crops that were scattered all over the land that he was on. And so when he used that word, it immediately evoked for everyone the process, the experience of what it's like to grow, to cultivate plants and in fields. And when you, I don't know if anybody's, you know, if you have your garden or anybody's, you know, worked on a farm or something like that, or in that process, you know, and what that process is like. It's one, it's earthy, isn't it? You know, it brings us to the ground. There's something earthy about it. It's messy. All kinds of things end up going awry, right? It's just the way it is. Like when I think of, you know, for us in Flagstaff, it might be similar for here in Salida. You know, our summers are not that long in terms of from one frost to the, you know, the ending of the last frost to the beginning of the first frost. And then in the middle of the summer, what can happen to us is you get the big hail, you know, and your poor little squash plants, you don't get out there in time to get your sheets over your squash plants, and they're gone. Now, do you blame yourself for the hailstorm when it happens? But it's amazing on retreat, you know, inviting this, just this willingness to be present, and then you have a challenge with being present, and then it's like you feel like you're doing something wrong. That's like as crazy as taking responsibility for the hailstorm. It's just the conditions that are there for that day. So there's something I think really important to start to get a sense of what cultivation is all about, the messiness of it, the earthiness of it, how we're getting our hands in the dirt this way. And that I can't make it happen. You know, we plant and then you cultivate. You offer the conditions to the plants, maybe watering them, or you know, maybe if you have a chance to get the sheets out in time when the hailstorm comes. And then the plants are going to do what they're going to do. You know, you might add, you know, compost and things like that, but there's so many factors that you're not in control of. You know, you can get an infestation. Sometimes it's a wonderful crop. Sometimes not. But do you hear how it clarifies my role? My role, it's more of a kind of a quality of being a midwife of a farmer, where you're just hosting something along, and then whatever happens, happens. And so much of our suffering, not only around meditation, I mean, we're just bringing the same exact mind to meditation that we bring to everything else, which is important to begin to see, is that so much of what my suffering comes from is I can believe that I have so much control over my experience. But I don't. I can influence it like a farmer does, but I don't control it. And so I think this image of cultivation is so important. So we're just here to come together to put forth some conditions, and then we notice what happens. And it's just going to be this one condition of this willingness to be present. And I think, as many of you have heard before, this is why I don't talk about that we're here just to be present. You just need to be here to be willing to be present. And then if your mind's not present, that's okay. You know, you're putting forth the condition that you have the most influence over. So it's that simple. We're coming together to do this together, to influence in a certain direction. And maybe another angle on this, and Phil, thank you for this morning. I love what Phil said to me. He's like, you know, coming here, setting up, it feels like setting up for a party, right? Getting all the chairs out and everything set up, and I so love that frame. You know, it's also to me sometimes what can be helpful is just a chance to be, a willingness to be present, and especially for those of you who have done a lot of retreats, a kind of celebration, just to celebrate this practice and this path, and to feel that sense of celebration. For example, in the Zen tradition, the Zen master I practiced with, he told us the Zen word, I think the Sino-Japanese word for Dharma talk is Teisho. And he said the translation of that word Teisho is, it's a celebration. Celebration of the Dharma. Yeah. Given the Zen tradition, I can't tell you if that's exactly true because, you know, he's so creative in the way that he... It might not be factually true, but there's something, you know, true about it in terms of our practice. Yeah, to celebrate. And so especially for those of you who have done a lot of retreats, I just invite you that sense of like, oh, this is a kind of celebration. We celebrate this willingness to be present. It gives a different feeling like, oh, I need to get something down this weekend and I need to fix all my problems and figure things out. And it's more like a party. You just, what do you do when you go to a party? You just go to celebrate. You know, you're not hoping to like come back with like even a better life. Maybe you're hoping not to have that much of a hangover, but you know, it gives a different feeling. And I also offer that frame because the mindfulness, and rightly so, it's been situated in the healthcare system, which I think is wonderful. So, I just like with any narrative, as I was beginning, I wouldn't want any story or narrative to confine our sense of the practice. And so that might be something that fits for you. Of what does that feel like to come here more as Phil was saying, as a party? And this is what we do. I know it's a strange party. This is what we do here. We're in silence, and we have this willingness to be present, and we slow down. But I think it can feel like that. And it changes our attitude. Because sometimes there's even a desperation that I really need to get something out of this practice. And that's a good thing. You know, having less stress in our life, that's what this is about. But also we can start to get rigid about it too, about what that whole process is about. So it's this shaping model, a shaping of the heart. This one quality, this willingness to be present. And just to share with you a quote, and this, especially for those of you who are doing the residency, you could say this is in some ways the theme, you know, of the Buddha's insistence of the power of what we're doing. He says, develop the wholesome. So the wholesome is that which is onward leading in our lives. Another translation of the word kusala or wholesome is develop that which is skillful for your life. And then he says, it is possible to develop the wholesome. If it were not possible to develop the wholesome, I would not tell you to do so. But because it is possible to develop or to cultivate the wholesome, therefore I tell you, develop the wholesome. To develop what is skillful. In another passage, he says, it is but because of this development of what is skillful or what is healthful, or what is wholesome, is conducive to benefit and pleasure, I say to you, develop what is wholesome, develop what is skillful. Isn't that interesting? He uses the word pleasure. Well, this leads to a certain kind of pleasure. Around this willingness to be present, I think sometimes I just boil it down to two qualities. One is I want to point out, which I point out in many retreats, the kind of effort needed to be present. Like, if you were just to feel your hands right now, how much effort does it take to feel your hands? How much? Not very much, thank you. Thanks. Phew. You make my, would have been difficult if somebody said, it's taking me a lot of effort right now. You would have ruined my talk. And I did not plant the two people that said that, just so you know. It's true, it just doesn't take much effort to feel your hands, does it? It's really so simple. Where does the effort need to lie? It lies in remembering to be present. Like, I can feel my hands, but what makes it so difficult is I forget to do that. I can feel the breath, you know, pretty easily. What makes it so difficult is the forgetting, it's just the remembering. So to be aware of where you're placing your effort, because a lot of times there can be this like efforting, like I gotta be with the breath, I gotta stick with the breath, and like, but it doesn't take that much effort. Or being with the sensations on the bottoms of the feet. So this is one of the things about the willingness to be present. That's why there needs to be this willingness again and again and again. It's the, you could say, the remembering to be present. And this is what I'm going to really invite you to explore. And then the other thing is just having a quality of okayness of what's going on. You know, and again, when I say okayness, it's still, when your mind is lost in thought and you have the moment, this is a very important moment. When you recognize that thinking is happening, that is a moment of mindfulness. So do make sure that you're not just quickly coming back to the breath. You skip over an important moment of noticing, of being mindful that thinking has just happened. It's what I call after-the-fact mindfulness. Oh, interesting, thinking just happened. Oh, planning, remembering. That is a significant moment. It's just as good as when you're being with the breath. Because what can happen, it can be like, oh, thinking, damn it. Breathing. Go back to the breathing. Oh, yeah, this is the practice. No, you're skipping over noticing the fabric of your experience, which is thinking has just happened. So, yes, we want to step out of the thinking and having that skill of being like, okay, I'm not going to follow that story right now, but I want to be mindful that it's just been happening. So stepping out, but also being okay that thinking has just happened. Are you hearing this nuance? I don't need to fight my experience, but I also need to be willing to come back from being lost, even if I'm lost 10,000 times in one sit. But that moment, I really invite you to train in being like, cool, I just noticed thinking, rather than thinking, I'm gonna come back to the breath. We miss a really important moment of mindfulness. So yeah, okay with how it's going on and still a willingness to step out of being lost. Like the, and I think this, you hear this in Tibetan Buddhism sometimes, this gives you this image of how a the ideal grandparent is with a child. And when you imagine how that is and those conditions for that, it's, you know, when you're a grandparent, you're not fully responsible, which is pretty cool, right? You can just hand it off again. There's the more spaciousness around it. And then also often, you know, by that time, you're not as neurotic about it. You know what children do and you don't take it personally. And you're not trying to, you know, maybe you've gotten over trying to shape that child into the child you want it to be. And there's just a being okay with how it is, how that child is. There's a more of a softening in that kind of love and that care. And yet there's a deep, deep sense of care, a deep heart connection that's there between a grandparent and child. It's that sense of okayness. There's a warmth, there's a touching into experience, but you're not rattled by it. maybe the way it was when you were simply a parent. So those qualities of remembering and acceptance. And when we cultivate our hearts and minds in this way, I think it can be what I've noticed, the thing that can bring the greatest safety to my life and the greatest ease. What a valuable thing to do. Like, as the Buddha says, this comes from the Dhammapada, which is a collection of sayings of the Buddha. He says, whatever an enemy might do to an enemy or a foe to a foe, the ill-directed mind, you could say the mind that there's not a clear intention with, can do to you even worse. I think it's so true what our minds do to ourselves. It's so damaging. And when you think about it, sometimes you can realize, wow, I've experienced more damage from my own mind than other people sometimes. Maybe not always. I don't want to universalize anything.
Would you read that again?
Yeah, whatever an enemy might do to an enemy or a foe to a foe, the ill-directed mind can do to you even worse. And then oppositely, whatever, you know, the archetypal mother or the archetypal father or a great friend might do for you, the well-directed mind can do for you even better. There's something so powerful about these minds, and to have a chance to spend the weekend to shape it into, kind of just coax it into the willingness to be present. So again, it's just this turn into being present. That's all we're doing. The image that I often use, and I get this from another teacher, Sukhni Rinpoche, is it's just like you're on a ship in California and you have your rudder and we're just turning it a little bit into being present. Like right now, you can make this simple turn into feeling the breathing. You can make the simple turn of feeling your body sitting. Can you feel that turn? It's subtle, isn't it? But can you feel how it shifts how you are with experience when you start to feel your breath right now or your body? It's that turn that I'm inviting you to really investigate and get a feel for it. And just as if you're on a ship and you slightly turn the rudder and you're in California, it can make such a vast difference. You can end up in Korea or the South Pacific Islands just from this subtle turn over time. That's the shaping of the heart and the mind. But you need to start to get a feeling of like being lost and then making this slight turn of like, oh, here it is. This is what it feels like. So just a few, I just want to go over kind of the nuts and bolts of our retreat together. We have been sitting for a while, so if you need to stand while I continue to talk, feel free to do so. Really, don't be shy about that if you need to move your body.